in relation to the Retirement Incomes Task Force. So what does this mean? This means that we have a very talented panel led by Catherine Nance up the front here, but we're actually expecting lots and lots of industry participation, i.e. you guys. Firstly, just to introduce Catherine. Catherine is a partner at PricewaterhouseCoopers and heads up the Retirement Incomes and Asset Consulting Group. With over 20 years' experience advising financial services organisations, both profit and not-for-profit, and government, her areas of expertise include advice to corporate industry and government superannuation funds, ageing Australia, and in particular financing the ageing and product development, financial and statistical models, and being a licensed investment advisor to institutional customers. Catherine is also the chair of the Institute of Actuaries National Retirement Incomes Task Force, which deals with ageing Australia issues. So before we begin, I'll hand over to Catherine to just introduce her panel.
Thanks, Anthony. Okay, so I'll introduce all the members of the task force. There were a few that couldn't make it here today. So on the task force, there's Richard Cumpson, Richard Madden, Jim O'Donnell, Paul Scully. None of them are here today, I believe. And Steve Schubert and Tracy Polder are on the panel with me. So we're working on a number of proposals at the moment for around age pension reform and financial management of post-retirement savings and risks, with the idea of having a paper ready within a few weeks. And the paper is going to focus on options in this area and pros and cons, rather than necessarily coming down with an institute view, because the purpose of what we want to achieve is more about creating discussion in the Australian market and with Treasury and the regulators and so on, and different groups like ACOS and other industry groups. It's not about necessarily formulating an institute view. So again, today what we thought we'd do is just set up a panel discussion where we talked about some proposals, and with very much the aim of getting your input into some of them, like what you think are the issues and pros and cons, so that in preparing this paper we can make it reasonably complete. And the idea is that within a little while we present it down across a wide group of people, maybe in Canberra, government and so on, to get their views. So specifically, the sorts of policy changes we want to create, changes to the age pension or financial management, but things that would result in increasing the average retirement age, increasing workforce participation at older ages, reducing reliance on the age pension, particularly at younger ages, and encouraging generally a more effective use of savings in retirement. And a possible outcome of those things may be that if the age pension is targeted more, that it could also increase, because there is a lot of discussion about the age pension, particularly for single people, being quite low, potentially below the poverty level, definitely below ASFA's modest income type level. And the news at the moment, as you would know from the latest budget changes where the pensioners are out there in the street, is that they don't view the single pension as being possible to live upon. So although this type of age pension and savings reform is not necessarily immediately imperative, the fact is that to make any changes to this area requires usually like 10 to 15 year lead times, because you've got to give people a lot of warning if you're going to change these types of systems. And so we feel that it's really important to get it on the agenda and get it discussed now, with the aim of potentially being part of the government's policy reform for the next term. We also view that at the end of the day, it's probably going to be a portfolio of changes that will make a difference, not just hanging hat on one particular change. So the things that we're going to discuss today around age pension reform are increasing the pension age. It's been a proposal being promoted by a few different groups. Introducing an increasing pension in deferral scheme, replacing the dual income and assets test with an asset test only. And on the other side, the facilitating the management of savings, we're going to look at capital market alternatives such as annuity products, mortality swaps, longevity bonds, pooled life funds, and government alternatives such as issuing inflation-linked bonds, longevity bonds, or allowing individuals to purchase the age pension. There's a few that we've not got on there, but we're happy to discuss, like universal age pension, compulsory annuitisation. That may just come out through discussion, but at this stage we weren't intending necessarily on raising those, but we're happy to talk about them if you would like to. And generally we want to get to the point of talking about what is the appropriate role for government in this sector. Is the appropriate role to be almost like a semi-product provider, or to lay product purely to the capital markets and maybe just have the government facilitate the product development. And what does that mean? So particularly if you are from product providers, it would be good to hear from you as to what things you would need from the government to facilitate product, because as you know, there's almost no product of any note in the Australian market apart from account-based pensions. So if we start with age pension reform, and the idea is we're just going to split it about half and half. So the first one, some of the key current issues with the age pension as is that the income test is obviously a major deterrent to people working beyond age 65, and as such we have very few people that work beyond age 65, that's around about 10%. The asset test possibly also has some disincentives implicit in it, in that people can obviously use their assets prior to age pension age and effectively get the age pension, just compensate for it. The complexity of the income and assets test, and Anthony Ash's paper had a lot on that. And the other problem is the fact that the pension is quite low. A single pension, $14,000 a year. The Westpac ACCESS study said that $18,000 a year was a very modest level of income. Compared to a couple where the pension is $24,000 and the Westpac ACCESS study was $26,000. So the couple age pension is a lot closer to their level of modest income, but the single pension is a lot lower. So if we start with age pension, increasing the age pension, what I'm going to do is just basically introduce each of these things, throw it to the panel for some initial comments, and then the Jerry Springer of the actuarial world will be in the audience trying to get your comment on it. So, okay, increasing pension age. Generally, the proposal, if we take, you know, there was a CEDA proposal, there's been other groups, but what we're really saying is that it's currently 65 for males, 63 and a half for females. It's been that way since 1900. There's a global move to increasing pension age, US, UK. The sorts of proposals out there would be to increase it from something like 65 to 67, from 2015 to 2022, and possibly reviewing it thereafter. So, panel, some initial comments.
I'll take some initial comments. One of the main things we were thinking would this actually make a difference? At the moment, for males, the pension age is retirement age, where they can get a pension, is age 65. Yet, I think it's average is 61 that they retire. So, will this actually be making a difference? And can we just apply this to everybody? Realistically, if you're a tradesman or in a certain socioeconomic group, maybe you're not. You might want to work to 65, but realistically, you physically can't work to 65. So if we increase the pension age to 67 or eventually even higher, are we really, really discriminating against those groups in our society? They were just some initial comments to get us going.
I'll just make the additional observation that I know some of the discussion around whether the Australian eligibility for pension age should increase refers to international experience and what's happening in the US, for example, where the age pension age is gradually being increased from 65 to 67. I think what some of the public debate about that omits is, in fact, what they have there is basically an eligibility age for a discounted pension, which is around 62, and what's being increased is the age at which you're entitled to the full pension. So it operates rather more like an old-style defined benefit pension scheme with ages from which you can early retire on a discounted benefit. What we'd be talking about here in Australia more commonly is an increase in the absolute age at which you become entitled, where essentially it's as was discussed in the last presentation, a binary outcome. You're either across the age and eligible, or you're under the age and not eligible. So I think that is a difference in the Australian system.
Okay, comments from the floor. We've got a roving microphone. Melinda, our first victim.
Thanks, Jerry. I think that if, you know, the pension retirement age has been 65 since 1900. So, I mean, what was the life expectancy back then? I don't know. It was maybe 10 years. Yeah, there you go. I think that logically we should be looking at increasing it, because people are now living till well into their 80s, perhaps 90s, and as we've been hearing in some of the other sessions, people starting out working now will probably live till 100. The problem with people not physically able to work beyond 65 or even beyond maybe 61 now, if we're seeing quite a lot of early retirements, could be overcome if there's a disability type of income benefit, you know, maybe changes around that so it links in. So if someone's physically not able to continue work, they can get something that gets them through until they reach pension age. But for the vast majority of people who can physically work, I mean, what are we all going to do for 30 or 40 years in retirement? We'll all be bored silly.
Anthony.
Thanks. So the other issue is the question of discrimination against older workers, which has been shown to be to exist and becomes more and more concerning to me as I approach that age. But it is there, and while clearly you don't want to force people to work, if you know that there is discrimination that operates, and that means, I think, that our diversity sort of legislation and action should be working at getting older workers back into the workforce.
Thank you. Marie-Lise.
My comment's just about whether anybody's done a mortality study based on socioeconomic status, and if the people who rely on the old age pension or of lower socioeconomic status are also going to have these mortality improvements, and therefore whether it's fair to them to increase the age pension age.
I think that's been one of the pushbacks about increasing the age pension age is how fair it is. Is it across the different socioeconomic groups? Because the higher socioeconomic groups live longer, so benefit more from a longer period potentially being on it, and potentially the low ones might also be the ones that might find it harder to actually keep working for a longer age too, because they're in more physical occupations. So that's one of the pushbacks, and I think it'd be good if we had some, if we were going to put this down as one option to be considered, if we had some ideas of how to handle that, because there's no doubt that groups like ACOS and a lot of, and politically, they would get a lot of heat from this type of suggestion.
Can I just add that there are some statistics around that. It's been work done in the UK and in Australia, and it's all, you know, very difficult, of course, to measure, but some broad outcomes were that the difference in life expectancy between socioeconomic groups 1 and 2 versus 4 and 5 seemed to be around 2.5 to 3 years, which is not trivial.
But, of course, you could argue that this is a more fair approach, that incorporated decent disability benefits actually would discriminate less than the current situation is discriminatory, because it is a single age. To increase it from 65 to 67 doesn't change the discrimination, it just changes the place at which it happens. If we want to really be fair, we should actually look at the question of life expectancy and give someone a pension when they get to the point where their life expectancy is equal to 15 years or something.
I'm sure the government would say that only an actuary could suggest that.
I won't go there. I think the heat in just increasing the pension age comes from, as Steve said, the fact that we have essentially a binary system. Increasing from 65, while it all makes sense to us as actuaries, will, as we all know, attract a lot of heat out there. And you know, the pressure will be on governments to rule it out immediately. I suspect that a more successful approach will be if we think of moving to a system like, as Steve mentioned, overseas, where we perhaps fix the pension that's available at 65, or at least de-link it to AWE, increase it perhaps at a lower rate, and then push more this message that if you wait till you're older, you get a more substantial pension.
Yeah. And that probably...
Which is there at the moment, but I was... Sorry, just to finish that off.
That's effectively the pension deferral scheme, but yeah. I suspect that's, you know, that's not well known at the moment and perhaps needs to be beefed up to turn it into where people think in terms of my real entitlement comes if I stay until age 70, as against sort of the mentality still being at age 65.
It's probably a good lead into the next part. So I'm happy that people might want to keep making comments as we go through on topics we've already covered. That's okay. It's just that I want to make sure we sort of get through the body as we go. So did you want to say...
Margaret Gardner.
You go.
I just wanted to comment that one of the problems with people working longer, I think, is this feeling that where people are already exhausted. They look forward to retirement as being, I'm not under the pressure I'm under now. If somehow we could improve the ability of the employers or change of careers or something like that around 60 onwards, where people don't necessarily want to be the managing director anymore, but they maybe want to work 4 days a week, 3 days a week, that sort of job share, other sort of work. I was thinking some of your people who are tradesmen just might be able to move into something that still is doesn't require exactly the same skill, but maybe less physical sort of skills. I mean, we all have gardeners in the garden, and they're considered not to need quite so much activity as, say, a building worker, and they're not lifting heavy things and that sort of thing. And I think we just need a bit more thought outside the square of how to encourage people to stay in the workforce where they're not compelled to be there 5 days a week, 12 hours a day.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think with the ageing workforce, employers are going to have to get their heads around this. There was a recent survey anyway where something like 72% of all recent retirees said they would have stayed in the workforce if they'd been allowed to have more flexible hours. And I think employers have been a bit slow to take that up, but they'll get to the point where they don't have a choice. They have to. So it'll be a supply and demand issue. Just moving on. The next option.
I think Darren has a burning comment to make, and he has some little known.
I was actually going to throw to Darren anyway because of the disability pension, because that was one of Darren's proposals. So it's probably a good time as any. Darren, you had that proposal just to can the age pension full stop and just have a disability pension? And can I just ask, it'd be good if you could talk about that. One of the issues, though, that I wouldn't mind if you could talk about is the dignity in old age issue, which you yourself raised. How would, in practice, that work if we were requiring every elderly person to sort of check in with their doctor to prove disability every year? So do you want to make a few comments about your proposal?
Yes. You'd be shocked if I said no, I guess. I think the age for the age pension is completely arbitrary. Whether it's 65 or 67, it's actually not a very logical date to stop work if you're physically fit. And I think that disability is a much better sort of threshold to become eligible for social security benefits. Interestingly, today, a lot of people retire early and get social security benefits via the disability support pension. I think in 2000 was about 30% of all people over the age of 55 were on the disability support pension. Now, that's just amazing that 30% of the population could be that way. So I think the disability is a better test. It does come with dignity issues that you would need to prove disability to become eligible. But I think on the flip side to that, there is dignity issues in being retired and not being a valued person, arguably, in society because they don't want to employ you for your skills when there is clearly a future shortage of new entrants coming into the workforce. So I think the dignity issue has two sides to it. There's the dignity of being usefully employed in your old age, and quite frankly, there's a Generation X, Y factor here. At some point, Generation X and Y might legitimately ask, I think, why should taxpayers subsidise the leisure of people who are healthy and capable of work? Now, that's a bit of a controversial one, and baby boomers have the political power, so I don't think that question will be answered for a little while. So the dignity issue is important, but I think it has a flip side.
Thanks, Tara. I'm looking forward to you tagging on the naked pensioners out in the street asking them that question.
I think we have a response now from APRA to that one.
Sorry, disclaimer. This is a personal as opposed to an APRA view. APRA doesn't have a view about increasing, reducing or paying any age pension at all. I think the problem needs to be defined in a broader context. What we seem to be saying is because of the bulge of the baby boomer population and the pressure on the taxpayer with the current ages and rates are left unchanged, then there would be an intolerable burden on the taxpayer. But we seem to be also saying, or at least implicitly suggesting, that in helping this cohort from their retirement to their death, we will also assume that it is their God-given right to preserve their assets and pass it on to their next generation. I think we should question that assumption. In other words, is there an obligation for people in a country where there is no gift tax and there is no estate duty that you subsidize them or you provide them from the point of view of people who are working $35,000, $40,000 today and paying taxes so that these people can pass on their multi-million dollar mansions tax-free to their children?
Yep.
I think we need to answer that. These may not be actuarial questions, but actuaries are only one part of the slice.
Okay, and we'll get, because some of that thinking comes through in a couple of later issues as well. Okay, so let's move on to the pension deferral scheme. There is a very basic pension bonus scheme at the moment, but it's not financially neutral to a person. It's a lump sum that you can get after a few years. It's pretty poor, really low take up, not very. What we're thinking of is something a lot more comprehensive than that, where there is still like a nominal commencement age of the age pension, whether that's 65 or whatever. But basically, you can defer, if you still have an eligibility at that stage, you could defer it and continue to work or live off your own income. And the pension rate would go up around about 6 or 8% each year. A couple of other countries have it. And the reason for doing that is because at the moment we've got a very high effective cost for people to defer going on the age pension, because the age pension doesn't change. If you simply defer it and keep working, you pay tax, but you also lose the age pension. And we're one of the worst countries in the world for having quite a negative incentive for people to keep working at all. So we really have to remove that. If we made it financially neutral, like 1 year deferral, the age pension was up 8%, it's financially neutral to the government. It doesn't cost the government anything. In fact, they win through mortality. Obviously, people won't always make the age where they defer it out to. But if we look at, like, the difference it would make. Suddenly a $14,000 per annum single person's pension, if a person could actually live and work on live on their assets, work or whatever, a combination, until age 70, that $14,000 per annum pension is now $20,000 per annum, which is getting much, much, much closer to a reasonable level of living. At 75, it would be $28,000 per annum. So basically, it would give a more acceptable level of income, and it would encourage people, have an encouragement there, to actually stay and live whatever resources you have, savings, work, whatever, just living on them for longer. So the idea is it would replace the very restrictive lump sum pension bonus system. There could still be an option to have a bit of a lump sum bonus built into that deferral, but generally the deferral will be through an increased age pension rather than a lump sum. So, comments?
I had a few. One, just thinking about it, does this deferral almost encourage people, we're saying it encourages them to use their own savings, but because they know that they'll be getting the $20,000 in 10 years' time, do they blow it all in their first 10 years of retirement? That could be something that happens. Also, would you have a maximum period of deferral? For example, someone might be able to defer till 80 and then they might be getting a fairly high pension from the government, which is not something that we're used to in Australia, and it may be a bit difficult to bring that in as well. Steve, I don't know.
Oh, we've got somebody. We've caught someone in our net.
Sorry, it's Darren again, hogging the microphone. The issue about the tax deferral of the age pension, I think, there's another possible solution to that, and that is to simply exempt personal exertion income from the income test. So you're achieving the same thing. You're giving people an incentive to work, and while you're not deferring the pension, you're actually giving it to them, but it does provide an incentive to stay in the workforce longer. That might be another way of doing it.
Yeah, that was our next option.
Ken Dance, as a 68-year-old part-time worker, I'm old enough to remember the original introduction of the assets test, and it was basically because people were hiding assets And if we just go back to a single assets test again, I think we might go back to finding ways of hiding assets again. I think the combination of both income and assets testing has got a lot of merit. And if we want to encourage continuation in the workforce, rather than totally excluding it, it could be counted at some reduced rate.
Okay, well, I might move on to that option, and bear in mind, just keep asking any question on any topic, but another option, and again, these things aren't necessarily all mutually exclusive either, was to remove the income test and just have the asset test, because the income test is quite intrusive, quite complicated, and never designed for earned income post 65. 80% of people are on the age pension, so that income test is a major significant deterrent. So how the asset tests could work would be simply that whilst you have a certain level of assets, you do not get the age pension, which is coming back to a point made before, that you have to rely on your own savings and use that before you actually become entitled to an age pension. It probably could work quite neatly with a deferral pension in a way, because it forces you to use your resources for more of a known period of time. One of the problems that's already been talked about in previous sessions is how hard it is for retirees to actually have to manage their assets for an unknown period of time with longevity. This almost forces them to be able to use their assets for a known period of time, knowing that the pension would be that much higher when they actually came to doing it. I'll take comments from the panel, but just, Ken, getting back to the issue, if they can't hide their assets under the current asset test, why would they suddenly be able to hide them under an asset-only test?
What makes you think they're not hiding them?
Okay. All right. So is it going to be worse?
I think the incentive to do it will be a lot greater.
A greater incentive.
As you pointed out, it's the income test that's the major operative one at the moment. But if you totally remove that, then the only test becomes the assets test, and it just focuses all attention on it.
Okay. Any comments?
Just want to comment on the obvious one, which I think Ramani also was kind of alluding to, is this whole issue of the family home. And, you know, we've got ourselves in this bind where, you know, it is just the sacred cow for capital gains tax purposes, for assets test purposes. And, you know, you can set the level at whatever you like. You can say, let's set the level at $2 million in any house over, you know, the value above $2 million. And the scaremongers will come out and say, well, remember when you bought your house, it only cost £2,000, and, you know, now it's worth, you know, $500,000 if you've got a median house in Sydney or whatever. It won't be long before it cracks the $2 million mark, and so we get into that fear-mongering thing. But it really does seem to be a profound distorter of behaviours and also a significant detractor from equity.
One of the things that I think is starting to occur in society is the switch of the balance of the younger generations towards the older generations, as seen by the more active vocal objections from the senior citizens, who will also be supported by their children, who are obviously concerned about supporting their parents in old age. One of the advantages that I see of moving the age pension age is to keep that balance more closely aligned rather than let it take its natural course. By moving it, advancing it, you would be actually changing the mix of voters.
Another possibility, of course, on an assets test is that with transition to retirement, people can take out their money now prior to the age pension age, which can mean that there's almost an incentive to use your assets to partially support yourself up to age 65, and then your age pension will lift up anyway, assuming your assets are in that asset test range. So one option is, should assets used like the 5 years leading up to age pension age be included in the asset mean test, much as gifting and deprivation provisions are now. So there isn't that incentive to use those assets to fund lesser work up to those ages. Does anyone have a view on that?
As Steve pointed out, the distortion which is created by the interaction of a gift tax-free, estate duty-free ability to pass on assets to your estate, but then the public taxpayer is still required to look after people is really very large. At the very least, I think Institute in doing this work should model the impact of a statutory reverse mortgage, whereby 10 days after my death, if my son pipes in and say, "Dad has died, can I have his $2 million property in Strathfield?" Say, "Yes, we looked after your dad and mum. There is a $800,000 charge which the taxpayer has paid. You can take the balance, but not everything." I think we should at least model it to see what kind of equity or lack of equity it produces.
Just further to that idea of Romani's, we heard this morning the floated idea of, I think it was in the press, that we take our parental leave and then pay it back to the government. We take our student fees and pay them back after when we can earn it. And it's a consistent approach that you borrow money from the government when you have no income and at some point you repay it. And if that's through death taxes or whether that's through a negative account balance, then I think that's at least a consistent approach by government, which would be an interesting change. It's also interesting that might mean out of your 90 years of life, about 30 of them you're borrowing money from the government and the other 60 you're paying it back.
Yep. It sort of raises some interesting political questions, isn't it? Like capping home death duties, you sort of think it's a bit, yes, ministerish, like what brave government, you know, is going to sort of, not suggesting that a lot of people wouldn't think that they were very good ideas, but it's hard task for governments to bring in these sorts of ideas, isn't it?
Can I make a couple of comments? I actually work in older people. Firstly, us women are finding that the retirement age for age pension is going up. Every 2 years it ticks up another 6 months, so it won't hurt for us to go up, for the scale for women to keep going up, and for you guys to join us. Secondly, yes, there are a lot of people on disability pension who can't work, but the pension and the means testing is exactly the same for them as it is for the age pension. And all this talk about deferring the age pension and getting the bonus, you have to actually qualify for the age pension before you can defer it. So you have to prove that you haven't got the assets or the income before you can go off and do that deferral. So that's a funny. They are offering you at the moment, I've got clients who do this, if you own a holiday house that produces no income but hits you hard under the asset test, and so you get a lower pension, you can do a deal with Centrelink that they will pay you the full pension, but when you eventually sell that asset, holiday house or whatever it is, you pay them back the accumulated value of that extra pension. Now, that's already operating. Now, whether you'd like to extend that and say, well, hang on a minute, we'll pay all of you the full pension, and then you can all jolly well pay it back. So those thoughts are out there. They're moving around. People are now doing reverse mortgages. But what I'm seeing is 60-year-olds doing reverse mortgages because they can't live within their means while they're still working. And that is a real problem because when they get to 80, they don't own any of the house and they're really limited. And an age pension is not much to live on, folks. And that message might need to get out there.
Okay, just moving on to the next stage, just so we can get some comments on this before we end. The options for really facilitating long-term longevity-style product development, the basic options that exist, there's capital market options of provision of annuity products, very unsuccessful today because of capital requirements, provision of mortality swaps or longevity bonds. This is all from the capital markets we're talking about here, or pooled life funds, which there's been a little bit of in Australia recently, discussion around in one Asteron product. The government alternatives along the same lines would be that the government could issue long-term inflation-linked longevity bonds, or the government could allow individuals to purchase the age pension, much like the previous conversation. So just for some initial comments on that mix between the capital market options and government alternatives to the panel.
Yeah, I sat in Michelle and Duncan's session earlier and they sort of talked about you know, from a utility point of view, that the older you get, the more logical it is to annuitise. And I'm lucky enough to have a colleague in the US who, you know, is in financial markets in New York. He was a fellow of the Canadian Institute and of the UK Institute, so he's, you know, pretty broad background. And he's also done some work in this area and reached the same sort of conclusion. He tackles it because he's now 60 from a very personal point of view. And basically, as a financial markets person, what he says is, I don't really want to hand over all my capital to a provider to provide me with a guarantee, because I lose a lot of flexibility. What I really want to do is take a call option, so that if and when I survive to, say, age 85 and I discover that I need to have longevity protection, I want to be able to call the option in there. And as he points out, the closest you can get to that in even in some markets at the moment is probably a deferred annuity, but that still involves you handing over a significant amount of capital in order to secure the contract in 20 or so years' time. And he says, well, I don't actually want to even hand over that much capital. Again, all I want to hand over is the option premium. Now, he hasn't, you know, attempted to calculate what the option premium ought to be, and it obviously depends on the existence of markets, but his discussions are going down those lines of, you know, why can't we develop essentially longevity bonds, longevity swap markets, etc., so that financial institutions can essentially offer these sorts of options or product riders, which allow you to maintain some flexibility over the bulk of your capital at least, and also allow it to be invested, as Duncan and Michelle's work shows, in higher growth opportunities that are available through that underpin essentially conventional lifetime annuity products.
Duncan Rawlinson, got a couple of observations on the current one. Look, longevity is a very broad-ranging subject, but I'd make a couple of observations. There have been some attempts, as some I'm sure in the room will know, at launching longevity bonds. Generally, they have not been successful, and there's quite a lot of literature around about what their good features were and why they were a surprising disappointment for those who attempted to issue them. But the question often gets asked, well, isn't the obvious issue of longevity bonds, shouldn't that be the government, you know, longevity or joint CPI and longevity linked somehow bonds? As a Generation X rather than baby boomer, my personal view is I think that's the last thing the government should be doing. It's for the Institute to decide its position, but for one, I'd be voting against supporting longevity bonds to be issued by a government. Why? Well, the government's already loaded up pretty heavily on longevity risk exposures, and I've yet to be convinced of the case that it should be doubling up that risk even more. Yes, I understand the merits of it. Yes, I understand from an institutional investment banker's point of view, they love those kinds of things because they can write stuff off the back of them. But that's their problem. There are other capital market solutions that I think should be tried first that are beginning to emerge, but have, I think, a long way to go. And while I'm at it, and I'm not sure will be as easy to do in the Australian market as might be possible overseas. I really don't see, when we're talking here about, well, the inherent costs and the affordability issues associated for the state of the age pension going forward, why on earth we should be loading up on longevity bonds, the idea of borrowing against home, government-sponsored. I certainly came across that when looking at equity release product designs a couple of years ago. Wasn't very well known at all that the government already had a kind of reverse mortgage on offer. They didn't call it that. They didn't seemingly promote it very widely, but it was something that was tucked away under the table for them to draw out in cases of extreme hardship. Institutionalising that kind of thing maybe has merit, although obviously it may introduce a property risk exposure for the government, which is a different subject entirely. But just coming back to one of the other points, the age pension, I don't confess to know about many other countries, but Steve, you mentioned about, you know, US and some issues there. The UK, obviously, by my reading, have done it pretty successfully to now put in place a program of increasing the eligibility age for the age pension. And the party that did it even managed to get re-elected after they did it, which was quite astounding. But the observation I make is, in whatever we decide here or develop here, can we be very careful, please, about making sure that we understand the reasons why that perhaps worked or why it didn't get the extreme reaction in the UK populace as seemingly it's getting here. And there are a number of reasons, I would say, quite particular to the UK market, why basically that succeeded. But I think it is going up to age 68 by about 2030 or thereabouts. They obviously have some real drivers that led them to feel they needed to do it. I'm not so sure that it's going to be as easy to do here, even on the basis of just the initial reactions that we've had thus far. The last point I want to make, Steve, coming back to yours, I'm not in touch with the thinking of the Retirement Incomes Task Force, but I sit in this meeting, I'm sitting here thinking, why are we talking about these sorts of things when 12, 18 months ago, whatever it was, we were supporting the idea of letting retirees post age 60 walk away with tax-free with all of their retirement proceeds. I think Steve, you made the point, well, there are various things in here that raise equity issues. I'm not sure what the drivers of this debate are, because if there are affordability issues, well, only 12 or 18 months ago, the Institute's work was saying, well, actually, there's not a lot of tax collected from retirees, so if we do away with tax, it's not a big issue. Well, every little percentage point seems to me to help. And what's our view then around, you know, the tax reform review that might be going on? Or should we, as I think I and a few others suggested at the time, whilst 60-year-old pluses might take their income tax-free, should we be actually stopping the ability for funds to grow tax-free post age 60 and actually taxing those at 15% just as we do every other balance? I'd lose from that, but I can see the equity in doing it rather than the situation we have now. So it's a very long-winded way of asking, how broad is your terms of reference, and are you focusing on those wider issues of equity that we've kind of navigated ourselves into?
Look, there's some issues that are outside our scope, such as the adequacy. We're trying to keep it focused on post-retirement, which is age, pension reform and product reform post that point. But part of that would be we'd be also picking up on the general discussion about the fact that at the moment all the ages are ad hoc anyway, and the whole question about taking tax-free benefits at age 60. I mean, I think, and a lot of people I think agree as well, that it was a big opportunity missed by the government to actually put that in at age 60 rather than 65 in the first place. So part of the paper might look at all the different ages and seeing if we can get some uniformity around some of the ages, because there's a lot of ages and a lot of bits of super that don't really tee up. And look, your point about the loading up the government on the insurance risk, we're really aware of that, so you don't have to sort of worry that we're sort of going to suddenly go down the path and say the government should allow people to purchase the age pension and should issue longevity bonds, because they're all basically the same thing, basically. It's all the government actually wearing longevity risk beyond the current level, which is the age pension, which is already a pretty substantial level when you think about 80% of the population over 60 being on it. But these sorts of things are put out there from time to time. So I guess going back to the original objective, what we want to do is put out all these things in a paper and have the pros and cons so people can understand what they all mean and how they all might be basically a similar concept, and is that concept palatable or even good sense from the government's point of view. If we go back to saying that capital markets are the most appropriate source of product, and generally I think governments are reluctant to get into product, wisely so, then is it going to be possible, and you made the point, Duncan, I think that there's been problems with that type of product overseas anyway, and the Australian market is that much smaller again. Is that type of product development going to be feasible in the Australian market, like longevity products brought out by capital providers? And if so, what would it take in terms of facilitating them?
I think one of the fundamental problems with longevity products is that people live a long time. And regardless of the capital structure, who provides it, if somebody's going to live until their 90s and retire at 65, that's a long time, and it's going to be expensive. One of my clients once said to me that only actuaries could think of living a long time as being a risk. So I think fundamentally, however you structure it, the problem is that there's this big, long time to fund. Can I just come back to the assets test and the income test and what the whole objective of this exercise is? If you sat down with a blank sheet of paper and wrote down all of the problems that you perceive with the age pension, about 90% of them relate to the means test. The disincentives to save, the distortion in how people invest and do funny things with bank accounts, disincentives to work, the complexity, all comes from the age pension. And I think the time is right to revisit the universal age pension. Australians actually accept universality in Medicare. I think it's politically easy to sell, we're going to remove the means test, with all of the people in their underwear down at Flinders Station would probably not be in their underwear. Well, actually, sort of have clothes on. But, I mean, prior to World War II, Australia actually had legislation passed for a contributory universal pension system, and it actually lapsed with the onset of World War II. So we've been there. I think Australia would actually accept that. And I think there is a perception, well, you know, James Packer might get the age pension. That's not very good, is it? But I think there's a way around that, and you can actually pre-fund the age pension by a tax, like extend the Medicare levy, and that would be perceived as an equitable outcome. So.
Some people would say that's what we had been doing for the last 100 years, supposedly, because the tax form used to have a name on it, something like taxation and pension form or something. So there was a view that that's what we were doing.
Hi, my name's Sam Wills. Just on the topic of what's needed in order to encourage this sort of market, realistically, I don't think it will occur in Australia in the first instance. The UK has institutions like the bulk purchase annuity players who are interested in this sort of alternative risk management, and realistically, they have a lot more exposure to this type of risk, so the chances are that they'll be leading the charge. But that said, we shouldn't sort of ignore it, I don't think. I think we should be open to the possibility of encouraging this sort of innovation, and in doing so being able to manage longevity risk for annuity providers and insurers. And so I think what's needed domestically is to encourage the retail longevity risk management market so that we can reach the critical mass at which we can start applying the lessons that may be learned from overseas.
What would encourage it, in your view?
Encouraging the retail longevity risk. I think government support would be a major issue, sort of explaining to people that they need to manage their longevity risk, and consumer education, so explaining to people they need to manage their superannuation payouts based on their sort of expected lifetime rather than their sort of maximum potential lifetime, and doing so gives them a higher year-to-year wage or year-to-year pension, so there is a benefit in them thinking about it from this perspective. We've just got to we have to have government to sort of take this on board, and also to educate consumers about it as well.
And advisors.
So knowledge.
Yeah.
Sorry, Cathy, just four points on this debate, which I agree with most people. I mean, firstly, there's absolutely no need for government to be involved. With-profit annuities work very well in the rest of the world, the US, South Africa, UK. Not a problem at all. The issue, as Darren points out, is that why develop an annuity product when it's taxed at 40% by the means test, income test? The only people who need annuities are those who fall foul of the income test. If you're so wealthy you don't need hit the income test, you don't need an annuity. If you're so poor that you're not affected by the income test, you don't need an annuity. It's only those in the middle. What do we call them now? Working families. who needed an annuity. Now, and I think, I mean, the point that Duncan has made, that politics is the issue at the moment, and I think we're too balanced. We should not be saying, give here and take away there. We should just say give. We should just say, we'll be saying very clearly, the income test is silly. It is an administrative atrocity. It cannot work. You cannot understand it. If you think it works, you cannot understand it. Read the form. It is rubbish. It is bad law. The best thing about the law is that it cannot be imposed. That's, you've got to see. If you think about it, it cannot be done, and yet we say it's good law. We must be mad. Certainly. So anyway. Sorry. It's got to be said a number of times. It's just got to be said again. Just two other points. Framing. On annuities, recent research has just suggested that the reason why annuities are not purchased is that they're framed as investments rather than consumption, as you've seen in the papers, Steve. And if people are told this is a consumption plan for the rest of your life, they say, oh, yes, that's what I want. If they're told this is an investment that may not pay out under certain circumstances, they say, well, it's a lousy investment. And then just on the politics, Adair Turner was the guy, the Turner Report in the UK that got the pensions age raised, very carefully behind the scene negotiations so that all the major players agreed when it was presented. And if we can do that, we can do it. But you can't have Adam Carlow or someone coming out against it. The real major players are probably both.
Probably have time just for this one last one.
So I alluded to this earlier, but one of the things that I understand went on in the UK is that, unlike here, obviously, or at least back 3 years ago, there was still quite a preponderance of defined benefit funds. And the way the system works there is you retire at age 60 in a defined benefit fund. It covers your age pension until the age at which your age pension actually kicks in from the state. I can't remember what the terminology is. So when the age pension age went up, the cost of that wasn't necessarily borne by the individuals. The cost was borne by the employer fund. Understanding those sort of subtleties, I think, is extremely important to understand why it might have got under the radar in the UK and why the behind-the-scenes discussions kind of all got cleared away. Because what they then try to do is something similar in public sector fund schemes, and they've singularly failed to move retirement ages, I think it is, in the public sector schemes, so which is a vast portion of the populace and the market. So when we say the age pension's gone up elsewhere, really got to understand really what's happened in those markets and who actually has been little affected, if at all, by that change. Where's the cost really being borne? Does that then have something to do about the politics of the issue?
Okay, I think that's probably all the time we have. Can everybody join with me in thanking Catherine and our expert panel?